It's 9 minutes after 6 o'clock. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and I'm Gene Purcell. I'll be filling in for Joy Cardine for the rest of this week. Should the government protect you from tuberculosis? Should the government protect you from smoking? Those are the kinds of questions raised by our guest this hour, but he gives a very different answer for each one. Jacob Solem is the senior editor of Reason magazine, a syndicated columnist, and the author of the book For Your Own Good, The Anti-Smoking Crusade and the Tyranny of Public Health. In a recent column, he talks about the kinds of public health threats the government should be focused on, and smoking is not one of them. Risk behaviors like smoking are voluntary, he says, and time and resources could be spent on greater threats. You can join the conversation. Do you think the government is spending its time, spending money and time in the wrong places? Is it really a question of either or? Do we really need to be told that smoking is bad or that seatbelts are good? And wouldn't it make more sense if that kind of effort were put into the prevention of the spread of TB or a pandemic? If you'd like to join in, here's the toll-free number that you can call. 800-642-1234 is the toll-free number. If you're calling from the Madison area, our local phone is 263-1890, and the email address, we'll do it that way too, talk@wpr.org. Jacob Solem, good morning, and welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Good morning.
Well, first of all, let's talk about this column that you wrote. Obviously, this is something that you've been thinking about for a long time, but what was it about this tuberculosis case that really forced you to sit down at the keyboard and pound this out?
Well, I mean, this is a striking example of a true public health problem, because here you have somebody who is potentially contagious. Of course, that's a matter of dispute, exactly mm-hmm. how contagious he was, but he's going around and he carries a potentially deadly disease. It's very hard to treat, and people were obviously and understandably very concerned that he might transmit it to others. So there's a serious question about what the government should do in a situation like that. If you had an even clearer case where he was coughing up bacteria all day long and was highly contagious, It would be obvious that if he refused to heed the government's warnings about treatment or staying away from other people, that there would be a very strong argument for restraining him forcibly. And in fact, that does happen from time to time in TB cases and in other types of cases where people who refuse to take their medication are legally compelled to do so. And in this case, obviously, he was ultimately forcibly isolated in a hospital. So I'm not sure that was justified in this particular case. It really all hinges on exactly how contagious he was. He claims that he was not contagious at all, or at least that was what he was told. But everyone who talked about this recognized that the real issue was the threat that he posed to other people. They weren't saying we need to intervene to protect him from himself, to force him to treat this disease, even if he doesn't want it to be treated because of the threat the disease poses to him. People were concerned that he was a threat to others. And I think that is really the relevant question to ask when it comes to public health issues. And if you find yourself in a situation where something is being labeled a public health issue and there is no threat to other people, there is no danger that they're going to catch a disease or some other kind of health threat that's being imposed on them, then you're not really dealing with a public health problem. It may be a health problem, but it's not a public health problem.
What are some examples of what you see as perceived public health problems, I guess, that really the government and others are focusing too much time and energy on?
Well, I mean, a well-established example is smoking, but more recently, public health officials and academics have been targeting obesity, overeating, under-exercising, and that's clearly something that's very personal. You know, what you put into your body, how much you eat, what you eat, how much exercise you get. If the government is going to target those behaviors and try to either manipulate you or use taxes to push you in a certain direction, or perhaps use various other forms of coercion to try to get you to be thinner or to exercise more. You know, that is a really dramatic expansion of government power into an area that used to be considered your own personal life. And that is justified because people say that this is a public health problem. And my question is, why? You can't, you don't catch obesity.
Mm-hmm.
If you may be worried about a fat guy sitting next to you on the plane because it doesn't give you much space, but you're not worried that you're going to become fat because he's sitting next to you. So clearly that's quite a different case than somebody who's traveling with tuberculosis or some other contagious disease. So you really have to do more than just assert that this is a public health problem. It's a health problem, right, because what you eat and how much exercise you get affects your health.
Sure.
But that doesn't make it a public health problem.
Is there something special about the, I mean, is this unique to the United States, or is this something that you see all over the place?
Well, no, it's in many Western industrialized countries especially, you hear this kind of language. Obviously, in countries where real disease, you know, contagious diseases and true epidemics are still a big problem, public health people are focused more on those. And in fact, in this country, that was what public health specialists used to do. Was the main thing they used to do was to try to control communicable disease, also other kinds of threats that are imposed upon people, things like water pollution, air pollution. Those were health problems that they would try to control because they posed threats to people from the outside. Now, they were quite successful, especially in the case of controlling contagious diseases through a variety of measures, including better sanitation, vaccination, antibiotics, and so forth. And so, understandably, once they pretty much, not completely, but pretty much eliminated the problem of epidemic diseases, they started to look around and say, well, what can we do next? And they looked at what people were dying of at that point, and it wasn't so much contagious diseases. It was more and more chronic diseases. So they started to look at the factors underlying those, and also injuries, right? So things like whether you wear a seatbelt or a helmet on a motorcycle or on a bicycle, those started to be considered public health issues so that they could address the causes of morbidity and mortality as they evolved.
We're talking with Jacob Solemn this hour. He is the senior editor of Reason magazine, a syndicated columnist, and the author of a recent column that was published in a number of places, including Reason Online, The Difference a Germ Makes. And he talks about the role that government should play or shouldn't play in public health. If you'd like to join in, 800-642-1234. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Joy Cardine, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 18 minutes after 6 o'clock. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Joy Cardine. Coming up after 7 o'clock this morning, since the start of the No Child Left Behind initiative, student achievement has improved. After 7, we'll take a look at whether No Child Left Behind gets the credit it deserves. This hour, we are talking about the role of government in public health with our guest, Jacob Solemn, who is a senior editor of Reason magazine, a syndicated columnist, also author of the book For Your Own Good, The Anti-Smoking Crusade and the Tyranny of Public Health. Our discussion this morning has been sparked by the case of the TB case of Mr. Speaker, who has been traveling around the world, wound up back in this country, and a question of whether money spent on preventive programs by the government, like no smoking programs, telling us about obesity, helmet laws, seatbelt laws, and the like, could be better spent on preventing real problems like tuberculosis or the spread of pandemic. Jacob Solemn, I have to ask you this. Is this a stance that is, when you say this out loud, what's the general reaction?
Well, it depends to some extent on the issue, which is interesting in itself, because if you're talking about smoking, for example, people are much more willing to see that as a public health issue and to endorse things like smoking bans in restaurants and bars, higher cigarette taxes and so forth. And why is that? Because they don't smoke. most people don't smoke, so you get very, very large majority supporting things like higher cigarette taxes. But when you start to talk about something like obesity or excess weight, I mean, it's not just obesity, but also people who are considered to be overweight, which is most of us, well, then you're starting to talk about something that affects the majority. And the responses are quite different because these are their habits you're talking about, and they're more concerned about things like, well, special taxes on junk foods or various schemes for redesigning the world to make you exercise more and eat less, zoning fast food restaurants away from certain areas, for example, trying to manipulate people into walking instead of driving and so forth. When you talk about things like these that affect the lives of the majority, then people are more resistant to the idea that this is a legitimate area for the government to be involved in.
Well, let's find out what listeners think. We have a bunch who would like to talk with you. Lester joins us first, and he is in Madison. Good morning.
Good morning. It strikes me that the definition that you're using of public health is entirely too restrictive, and you are asserting that the only public health issues are issues of communicable disease. If you take smoking, for example, if in fact the science of indicates, and I think it does, that secondhand smoke is potentially harmful to me as a person who doesn't smoke, and smokers assert the right to smoke anywhere they want, it's a public health question as to whether or not that asserted right is a right that they have and ought to be able to continue. And secondly, in a broader definition of public health issues, smoking, for example, is known to cause a variety of diseases. And because we, to a certain extent, jointly as a community are paying health care costs, it is a public health issue. And to confuse it, and I think, and to argue it from the point of view, well, if you approach that kind of a public health issue, it's going to lead to all these issues with regard to restricting what foods people can eat, I think really changes the subject. The subject is much different than that, and you can't limit public health questions only to communicable disease.
Lester, thanks for the call, and Jacob Solomon, how do you define public health?
Well, I wouldn't limit it just to communicable diseases. That's the paradigmatic example, but there are others that I mentioned before, things like water pollution, air pollution, and the important distinction is whether this is a risk that's voluntarily assumed or a risk that's being imposed on you by other people. So in the case of secondhand smoke, well, in many situations, it's not really being imposed on you, right? If you go to a bar where they permit smoking, for example, you are choosing to go to that bar even knowing that they allow smoking there. That's somebody else's property, not yours, and they get to decide what the rules are. Of course, the government does have a role in setting the rules about smoking on public property, in courthouses and police stations, places like these. The government has to set some sort of policy. So in that sense, it has to be involved. But the fact that people generate smoke when they smoke does not transform the issue into a public health problem in general. And I would note that really smoking was considered a public health problem long before people started to worry about the possible effects of secondhand smoke. So that's really not the crux of the issue. It's considered a public health problem because of its effects on smokers. Not because of its effects on non-smokers. And as I said, you can address the concerns about secondhand smoke without making the whole thing into a public health issue. And as to the diseases that are caused by smoking, the problem with that principle is, first of all, the objection is not so much to the behavior itself as to the fact that when people get sick, other people have to pick up the bill. Well, that's the government is forcing you to do that. So maybe you agree with that, or maybe you don't. But if you agree with having taxpayer-subsidized health care, then you can't really object that some people do risky things and as a result end up being sick or injured, and then you have to pay for that. That's sort of the nature of having taxpayer-subsidized health care. And then there's the logic of that, of citing the risk that you might be treated at taxpayer expense as a reason to prevent you from doing dangerous things, really is completely open-ended. So it doesn't, as this caller suggested, apply just to smoking. It applies to anything you do that might result in disease or injury. In principle, it does. So the question of whether the government will actually get involved in regulating that, a particular kind of risky behavior, is entirely a political one. Is it politically practical for the government to do that? Now, as I mentioned before, smoking is much easier to tackle because it's just a minority of people who smoke. So politically, that's easier. Obesity is harder because it involves a majority, at least being overweight. Mm-hmm. Involves a majority. So I'm very troubled by this principle that says you have a duty to the collective or a duty to the government to be the best you can be, to not get sick, not get injured, to not do things that might result in disease or injury, because that could end up costing taxpayers money. And one other thing I should note, by the way, is in the case of smoking, it's not true that taxpayers are paying more as a result of smoking. In the long term, smokers actually save money. Why? Because smokers tend to die earlier, and they save money on health care and old age, on Social Security payments, on nursing home payments. So if you really want to take the fiscal argument to its logical conclusion, the government should be encouraging people to smoke.
I'll bet that's not a popular stance with you, with folks you talk to.
No, people don't like that too much, but really that is the logical implication of the fiscal argument. Now, what I'm saying, I'm not saying the government should encourage smoking. What I'm saying is the people who are pressing the fiscal argument don't really believe it, because once you show them the actual numbers, they retreat from that and they say, well, that's not really the reason.
We've got time for a quick call before the break from Mary, who joins us from Butler. Hi, Mary.
Yes, good morning, and I'm so glad this man is on the phone, on the radio, but you know what? He's way off base. I happen to be a non-smoker. I have never smoked in my life because I was too poor to buy cigarettes, and I'll never spend my money on that stuff. However, I have developed a very severe reaction to passive smoke. It's called an anaphylactic reaction. When I breathe cigarette smoke, my whole breathing system shuts down. I cannot even take a breath. I have been rushed to the emergency room 9 times from my work site because coworkers smoked in the area. And I had to go to the legislature and get them to change the rules at my workplace. And now, as a result, the entire correction system does not permit cigarette smoking. Thank God. And he's way off base. It doesn't matter whether you get a life-threatening illness, if you want to call it that, from a germ or a disease, or you catch it from somebody else next to you, or whether somebody's doing something that you cannot escape. And I'm so glad that the government gets involved in that. It is their job to do that. My whole life is regulated by where people smoke. I do not go where people smoke, but people smoke where I have to go.
All right, Mary, we're going to have to let Mr. Solomon get a chance to respond here. Thanks for your call, though. And we've got about a minute or so before we go back, but I imagine when you have these discussions, they turn into this where people just don't really agree with your viewpoint, even though they can sometimes see the logic of it.
Well, I mean, this argument that people are imposing the risk on you, that really is the relevant question. What I would say in a situation like that is if somebody comes into your house and blows smoke in your face, they're imposing that risk on you. If you are in a place that you have to go where you can't escape it, then you have more of an argument. But if what you're saying is because I am sensitive to tobacco smoke, no one may smoke anywhere, or no one may smoke in any bar or restaurant because I might want to go to that bar or restaurant, that doesn't seem legitimate to me. You know, people, for example, some people have extreme peanut allergies, and they can have life-threatening reactions to just the slightest whiff of peanuts. Does that mean that peanuts should be banned everywhere? And I would say no. You can say, well, the peanuts it creates a health problem for me and the government should intervene. But if it's on somebody else's property, they've decided to allow peanuts, you don't have the right to go in there and say you may not do that. So, but in a sense, the secondhand smoke issue is really a distraction because that is not the main reason that they talk about smoking as a public health problem.
Okay, and we're going to have to leave it there because we do have a break we've got to go to. We'll be back and we'll continue this discussion in just a few minutes here on WPR. Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 25 minutes before 7 o'clock, and I'm Gene Purcell. I'm here for Joy Cardine this week. Jacob Solomon is our guest this hour. He is the senior editor of Reason Magazine, a syndicated columnist, and the author of the book For Your Own Good, The Anti-Smoking Crusade and the Tyranny of Public Health. We're talking about a column that he had published in a number of outlets this week, including Reason Online, if you'd like to look it up, titled The Difference a Germ Makes. And he argues that in many regards, the role of the government in public health is overstepping its natural boundaries. Let's move on to callers. We've got plenty who'd like to join in. You can, too. We have an open line for you at 800-642-1234. You can also call us from Madison. Our local number is 263-1890. Right now, let's go to Waupun, and Tom is with us. Hi, Tom.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I completely agree with your guest. I spent about 3 decades in human services in and around, or mostly around public health in a lot of different places. And in all the human services and helping professions, there's wonderful people, and there's also an element of, just as the title of the book says, I know what's good for you, and you should do it. And that's it's frustrating because usually that doesn't work. One question I'd ask of your guest is, in my observation, public health doesn't tackle a real tough issue called alcoholism, and they seem to avoid that, like the plague. And again, there's wonderful things in public health, but I completely agree with the guest that I think we've probably overdone it.
All right, Jacob Solomon, there's somebody who agrees with you, and I don't know about the alcoholism. It seems to me I see a lot of public health efforts against that.
Yeah, that is considered to be a public health issue, and using the same rationale that they apply to other kinds of risky behavior. So you will see things like higher taxes on beer, wine, and liquor justified as a public health measure, zoning requirements about where you can sell alcohol, restrictions on the hours when you can sell. And what's interesting about that is that those rules and regulations, many of them originated with explicitly religious or moral justifications. Certainly prohibition had explicitly religious and moral justifications. And nowadays, they talk about it as if this is all highly scientific, and this is, no, it's not about morals, it's not about religion, this is about what the science shows. And that's really not true, because inherent in any public health policy that targets risky behaviors that people choose to do is a value judgment, which says you shouldn't be doing that. You know, you shouldn't, because of the risk involved, you should not be doing that, which is to say your health is the paramount value. You shouldn't be sacrificing or compromising or endangering your health in exchange for pleasure or even or relief from stress or for whatever the reason is you do what you do, whether it's drinking or smoking or eating. You should be thinking of your health at all times and not compromising your health for the sake of other things. And that is a moral judgment. And, you know, obviously you could make that argument. You could say that morally that's what you're required to do. But I want to hear that explicitly instead of having people say this is a public health issue as if that resolves the whole argument.
You know, you could argue, and I imagine a lot of people do, that in a democracy that the people get to choose what they want to do. And in this case, they've chosen to let the government do this. So do you think that it's been a conscious decision on the part of society, or do you think it's more, you know, people are sheep and they're just sort of eating what they're fed?
Well, I think you can say people can choose whether they themselves want to be bound by restrictions, I suppose. You know, you can go to fat camp, or you can enroll in a treatment program if you're a smoker and you want to quit. But when you try to force other people to behave as you think they ought to behave, that's where I have a problem. It's not just a question of people saying, you know, I need some help with my problem. They're saying, those other people need help with their problem. I'm fine. That's generally what people are saying is, I'm fine, but those other people, they're really doing these disgusting, reckless things, and they need to be stopped.
Let's go back to callers right now, and John is with us from Madison. Hi, John.
Hi. Well, since industry has the right to induce the populace by marketing, which is another name for propaganda, to engage in risky behaviors or increase their consumption of harmful stuff for the benefit of either the stockholder or the business owner, I think the government has the absolute right to do the exact opposite in a countervailing sense for the well-being of the average citizen. You know, there's a principle in this country that business, either small and large, are not exempt from social democratic control. When, you know, this goes to harmful products put out by business, worker safety, environmental degradation, business predatory actions against each other, monopoly formation, on and on and on and on. So we have the right to control business, and this is the essential issue that's being addressed here. But In other veils, but this is what's really going on. Industry doesn't want government control. If you look at the cost of cigarettes, obesity, and alcohol, together they add up to roughly 600,000 deaths per year, and there's roughly a little over 2 million people die a year. So a quarter of all deaths are due to these three things. Obviously, with this kind of death toll, government has a right to intercede in the public behest. You know, This is tantamount to a plague going on every year in this country. So certainly, TB resistant to the fluoroquines or whatever is an ongoing problem, but it's not either or. And as far as priorities goes, this has to be number one.
John, thanks for the call. And Jacob Solomon, our caller, says it's not an either-or situation. We have to try to do it all.
Well, in terms of responding to marketing of corporations, the appropriate response to speech that you don't agree with is more speech. It's not a force. So if people don't like the message that is being sent by the tobacco companies, for example, or by the fast food chains, or by manufacturers of alcoholic beverages, the proper response is to point out how they're misleading or what they're saying that's wrong, or to emphasize the dangers of these products, or whatever it is that you want to do. You're perfectly free in this society to do that. But to say, because these guys say things that we disagree with, we are going to tax the product, that is not a voluntary thing. That involves a kind of compulsion. We're going to put a special tax on the product. We're going to restrict what they're allowed to say, which is something else that public health people advocate, restrictions on advertising. So now we're going to censor your speech because we don't like the implications of it. We think people are eating, they're eating too much junk food. Therefore, we're going to stop you from speaking. To me, that is not justified because you're responding to somebody else's speech by using force.
We've spent a lot of time this hour talking about what public health should not be doing, and we've got some time left in the hour. Maybe we should talk about what, in your mind, public health should be doing, and where do you think public health should be in this country?
Well, the problem is that I think the range of things open to public health is going to naturally shrink as things like contagious diseases get under control, and people in the field have to be willing to accept that. Clearly, there is still a need for control of things like tuberculosis. Rabies crops up every now and then. AIDS is obviously still a concern. You have serious communicable diseases that we still need to worry about, not to mention the possibilities of future epidemics or even biological warfare, that sort of thing. These are all risks that are imposed upon people by others where there is a legitimate argument for government intervention. And also, I mentioned things like pollution. That's always going to be an issue trying to stop people from putting toxins in the air, toxins in the water that can affect other people's health. These are all public health issues. Even things like fraudulently misrepresenting a medicine. It's being sold and you say that this is perfectly safe and effective, and in fact it's not. There's a legitimate role for government in that as well. So the question always has to be asked, does the government have a role here and why? That whole debate is often short-circuited by people saying this is a public health issue. I mean, I've heard things like gambling described as public health issues, things like watching violent TV shows. Hillary Clinton says violent entertainment is a public health issue. Well, really, anything can be a public health issue then, right? I mean, anything you don't like that you disapprove of can be described as a public health issue, and then you sort of have this assumption that, now, of course, the government has to be involved because it's a public health issue. But I want to have some more discussion of why that is, that we describe a particular issue as a public health one.
Well, we're going to have the opportunity to continue that discussion after this break. We're talking with Jacob Solemn. He is the senior editor of Reason magazine, also a syndicated columnist and author of the book For Your Own Good, The Anti-Smoking Crusade and the Tyranny of Public Health. He wrote a recent column that was published around the country, including in Reason magazine. I found a copy of it online, and it is titled The Difference a Germ Makes. And he uses the recent tuberculosis case as an example where public health officials could be spending more time and money working on cases like that and less time working to prevent things like smoking or telling people that they need to put on their seatbelts when they drive a car. If you'd like to join in, 800-642-1234 in Madison. It is 263-1890. And we have email as well. And that is talk@wpr.org. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Joy Cardine this morning. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 12 minutes before 7 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 9, Kathleen Dunn and her guests talk about comments made by Senator and presidential candidate Barack Obama on the Bush administration doing nothing to defuse a quiet riot among blacks that threatens to erupt just as the riots in Los Angeles did 15 years ago. That's coming up later on this morning here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we are continuing our discussion with Jacob Solemn, the senior editor of Reason magazine and the author of the book For Your Own Good, The Anti-Smoking Crusade and the Tyranny of Public Health. He is also a syndicated columnist, and we're talking about a column he wrote called The Difference a Germ Makes, where he talks about the case of the tuberculosis patient, Andrew Speaker, who traveled around the world back into America with TB, and he argues that the government, in terms of public health, would be better advised to spend more time and money on cases like that as opposed to telling people not to smoke. Let's go directly back to calls, and Carol joins us from Kenosha this morning. Hi, Carol.
Hello. First of all, I guess I'd like to make a comment and then ask a question. First of all, I love the way that your speaker is approaching the whole issue by using reason and logic. I think that's a very important way to do instead of just responding emotionally. And when we talk about the idea of smoking impacting other people's health, I see it in the school setting where we have parents who say that their children have very sensitive skin so that we can't use hand lotions, we can't use deodorants, we can't use hair care products that may smell because it impacts their child. And so I see that this emotional reaction really goes so far in some cases. But the question that I wanted to ask, and I'll take the answer off the air, is from your guest point of view using logic, are cell phones a public health issue to be addressed by the government if we're riding on the road and we have to be there, but other people are using their cell phones and thus causing accidents? I'm just curious how you address that with logic.
All right,
and
Carol.
I'll take the answer off the air.
All right, thanks for the call.
You.
And Jacob Solomon, we could probably spend another hour on this topic, but what do you think about it?
Well, I think distractions to drivers on the road are a legitimate public safety concern. I'm not sure I would call it a public health concern. In the same way that how fast people drive and whether they're in the right lane and so forth are public safety concerns. I think it's probably a mistake for legislatures to start passing specific laws aimed at particular distractions. So cell phones, for example, are targeted by specific laws that say you can't use a cell phone at all or you have to use a hands-free cell phone. There are many things that people potentially could do while they're driving, and in fact do, scold their kids, eat, put on makeup, read, look at maps. You know, all of these things are potentially dangerous on the road. I think there should be a general rule that you shouldn't be careless. You know, you should pay attention to the road, and if, in fact, you end up driving recklessly, or especially if you get into an accident as a result of your carelessness, there should be a penalty for that, whether it's through a lawsuit or through some kind of criminal penalty. I think it's a mistake to try to list every single possible distraction in the law as opposed to simply having a general rule that you enforce by looking at how people actually behave on the road.
You know, anytime an event happens, the tuberculosis case is probably a good example, it does seem as though lawmakers immediately, you know, convene hearings like they did yesterday in Congress to try to, you know, do something. And why is that in America that, in your mind, that if there's a bad accident, all of a sudden people will look at seatbelts? If there's a, you know, all of a sudden these things are top of mind and people feel as though they've got to do something right now?
Well, it's a natural human tendency to pay attention to dramatic events that happened recently. And it does no harm if all you're doing is reading about it, discussing and debating it, but if you rush to legislate, you can cause serious problems. I think Congress has a tendency to immediately try to legislate about whatever happens to be in the news, even if that problem is in fact not as big as many other problems that they're not talking about, even if the solution that's proposed isn't really going to work. So you always have to be careful in situations like that you're not overreacting to whatever happens to be in the headlines.
Let's head up to Wausau right now, and Frank joins us. Hi, Frank.
Hi, my name is Frank Rubino, and where government dovetails into trying to control or manage people's lives centers around where government pays the cost. Take, for example, the cigarette smokers. Now, you said that cigarette smokers die early. They don't die early. They die at they start having their problems when they're 60, 62, 65, at which point they go on Medicare, or if they're so terribly damaged by their smoking and they have lung transplants, the family is destitute, and they go on medical assistance, and the government pays the cost. For example, a 400-pound person that has smoked all their lives, damaged their lungs, has renal failure, kidney failure, 55 years of age, totally disabled, on medical assistance, government, you and I, the taxpayers, pay the cost of that health care. It is not that the smoker pays their cost. It's the rest of society pays the cost. Medicare is going bankrupt. There's not enough funding for medical assistance. Medical assistance only pays physicians 50 cents on the dollar. Government has to take a step in this because we are damaging ourselves, and then we expect government, people, we expect society to take care of us. I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Frank. We appreciate it. And there's another case, Jacob Solem, where somebody says the government does have a responsibility, and he argues your point that smokers die earlier. He says, while that may be, the cost of their dying and their care before they pass away is substantial to society.
Well, it's pretty clear in the case of smoking. I mean, every study that has looked at the total effect, not just the short-term effect, but the long-term effect as well, has found that while certainly there are costs associated with smoking, the fact that somebody dies of lung cancer, say, in their 60s means that they don't die of some other disease, say, Alzheimer's, in a nursing home when they're in their 80s, which is quite expensive. And also because smokers tend to die either after they've already retired or toward the end of their working lives, they've paid all this money into the Social Security system, and then they don't draw as much out as somebody who lives longer would. So I think it's quite clear in that case that you really don't see a net burden being imposed on taxpayers. I mean, especially if you take into account the taxes on cigarettes that already exist. I mean, that's without even considering those. So I don't think that's a good example. But certainly there would be cases. You can imagine cases of kinds of behavior. Motorcycle riding might be one of them. I don't know for sure because I haven't run the numbers. But you could imagine that if you have a risky activity that mostly injures people who are relatively young, perhaps disables them, doesn't kill them necessarily because that wouldn't be so expensive, but if they actually have to be maintained at taxpayer expense, that might on balance cost taxpayers money. Well, let's say that's the case with motorcycle riding, and I'm not sure that it is. Do we then say, well, let's ban motorcycle riding? Or do we say either because we want to have taxpayer-funded health care, we have to accept that some people will do risky things and taxpayers will pay for it, or, well, this is an argument against having taxpayer-funded health care. I think to take the existence of those programs as an argument for stopping people from doing risky things is a very dangerous argument because there is no end to that. It is a recipe for complete and total control over your life to stop you from doing anything that might hit the taxpayers in the wallet under some scenario. I mean, you don't even have the option to say, I have my own insurance. can I get out of the taxes on liquor and the taxes on cigarettes, for example, because I have my own insurance and the taxpayers won't have to take care of me? If this were a sincere argument, you would have to address that concern. What about the people who are paying for their own health care? Why should they have to change their behavior because you're worried that they're going to be expensed to you? But do we really want to live in a society where everybody is looking at their neighbor and looking at his activities and being resentful that the guy is doing things that are potentially risky and trying to stop him because he's worried, my taxes might go up? I don't think we want to live in a society like that.
Well, let's find out what Scott from Menasha thinks before the top of the hour. Hi, Scott.
Hi, good morning. I don't know. I'm not supposed to smoke, might get cancer. I'm supposed to wear my seatbelt. I'm not supposed to go to McDonald's. This guy with tuberculosis, everybody was in an uproar. But your guest is right. Where are the, priorities with diseases and stuff? With the AIDS and everything, they're almost promoting homosexuality. You can't say nothing bad or you hate them or something. But AIDS is a disease, and that thing is killing, thousands, millions a year. So he's right. Where are the priorities? They're working on the wrong things.
Scott, thanks for the call. And Jacob Solem, before we leave at the top of the hour, that side of what you're arguing really doesn't come up very often in public debate on these issues. I've, over the years, heard a lot of your seatbelt issues are big, speed limit issues are big. I mean, the list goes on and on. And your points really aren't heard very loudly. Why do you suppose that is? I mean, they're out there. There's nothing really new or particularly revolutionary, I don't think, about what you're saying.
I think that because the people who are advocating these policies, the politicians and the academics and the activists, take it for granted that they're right. They use the same rhetoric of public health that has long been used to justify things that are indisputably a function of the government. And people, frankly, just don't think about it very much. They don't analyze it and say, why is this a public health issue? And if this is a public issue, health issue, what isn't, right? I mean, a classic example is back when people were criticizing the anti-smoking movement for being invasive and nanny-ish and trying to tell people what to do, they would say, well, you're going to go after cigarettes now. Is it going to be cheeseburgers tomorrow? And the response to that is, that'll be ridiculous. Well, what's happening now? Now they're talking about going after cheeseburgers. So there is a logic, an inherent totalitarian logic to this very broad public health agenda that people start to perceive once you move from one case to another using the same arguments.
Well, Jacob Solomon, thanks for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time. Jacob Solomon has been with us for the past hour. He is a senior editor at Reason Magazine and author of the book For Your Own Good, The Anti-Smoking Crusade and the Tyranny of Public Health. Also a syndicated columnist, and we were talking about his column, The Difference a Germ Makes, published around the country and on Reason Online, which is where I found it, talking about the recent tuberculosis case. If you'd like a copy of the program, you can call the radio store, or you can listen to our archives. You'll find them online at WPR.org. Leo Duran produced this hour, and we had on-air production from Christina Taylor. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.